Security excellence through education. Corporate Security University.
Well, hello. Hello, everybody. Great to see you. This is Carlos Francisco.
And this is Scott Walker.
And this is Corporate Security University.
Security excellence through education.
And today we're hanging out with Andrew Saluk. I'm so excited about this stuff. Cox Automotive in the house, also known as what is his side job name, Scott?
I was going with Salukai. He sounds like a samurai. It's like an AI samurai.
Near and dear to my heart.
Yeah.
I like that. But we were calling him AI what?
Hobbyist. The AI hobbyist.
And I think that's what we're going to cover out here at Corporate Security University podcast today. A little bit of AI. Probably going to talk about all different types of things. I know we're going to talk about some quantum computing out there. I'm excited to talk about blockchain and how it works in security. I want to talk about a little bit about what scares me more. Is it quantum computing or AI? And, you know, a lot of generative AI is being done out there by a lot of companies these days. We have everything in anything. Maybe we can even go into like predictive analytics and what does AI kind of how does it infiltrate training, right? And we knew VR was a big thing for training. Well, still is a big thing for training, but how can we just incorporate all of that into one? I think it's going to be a great conversation. I'm excited. Andrew, are you excited, my friend?
I've been waiting to do this with you guys for I guess months now, and I can't wait for the discussion.
We're going to do what we do when we do while doing it. And that is, we're just going to throw it out there and see where it lands. But we're excited to have you, man. It's been a little bit for us in person, see each other in person, but on screen, nevertheless, works for me.
Yeah, this is great. And I really appreciate you guys putting the effort into making this a good broadcast and getting all the equipment. And I'm just delighted to be here.
That's how we do. It's all Scott. Scott is the greatest of all times. He is the GOAT of security, as I call him. Also a futurist, security futurist. I don't know if you knew that about Scotty, Andrew.
It's come up once or twice in our conversations. But I think one of the things that always strikes me about that term futurist, sometimes people will think, oh, that's off in the future, 80 years, 100 years. And it's certainly relevant to think about that time frame. But when we look at technologies like you mentioned, quantum computing, AI, the future is tomorrow and the future is 5 years from now. And there's order like leaps in that time frame that could be orders of magnitude.
That's right. Well, I like to think of things in kind of 5, 10, and 50 years. Mm. You know, the 5 and 10 are those near dates. And then, of course, should we be looking 50 years out if we can? So much has changed. I mean, you think about 50 years ago now was the beginning of the 70s. So we had put people on the moon and the astronaut program and SR-71 and stealth was just coming into fashion. So there's a lot that has changed since then. Now we have SpaceX getting ready to launch the Starship, and that I think we'll see that happen this year, or at least a successful flight test of the largest spacecraft ever made. So that's pretty exciting where we've come in 50 years, and I like to look at where we're going to go in the next 50, and I like to apply it to risk and corporate security.
Yeah. Let's get right into it then, Scotty, because we kicked off something yesterday. I thought it was interesting. Andrew, jump on. You ready for this? I have a presentation coming up, and a big shout out to ASIS Minnesota group out there in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I'm going to be speaking there on the 12th coming up. So one of the things that I end the presentation with, Andrew, is look, do we look at technology and the customer-centric approach to everything that we do in the future? Or do we stay on the same track? Are we comfortable with that in security, where we want to go, what we're going to do? And for me, as I was talking to Scott about this idea yesterday, because that's what we do, I said, man, you know, I'm starting to think that maybe tech customer-centric stuff that Scott and I care about, we talk about, maybe that's the next 25 years or so. But then what happens if something happens to where, you know, China would no longer have a working force to create chips that put, you know, that works, our cell phones and everything that goes chips, right? Vehicles and everything motivated. And then the U.S. continues to work on that fight where chips can only be made in the U.S. and we won't take anything else for our government stuff. And all of a sudden we don't have anything else, right? So 25 years went by. There's this peace in the world. And then boom, it just goes all the way to the right now, man, where it's like, okay, we're going to go back to bombs and bad guys style of security because we don't have any of those. So how good are we with technology? For how long are we going to be good with technology and all of the other geopolitical and stuff that affects it? Scotty has, man, has this thing down, Scott.
Yeah. I'd like to hear what Andrew thinks. You know, I think definitely we need to talk about AI and see where its place in the world will be and is currently. But my big concern is that we have a lot of technology that we need to apply to AI that just won't be able to be made at scale. So that's my concern. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that, Andrew.
It's a fascinating point that you raise. So I would even take it. Take maybe one additional step there and say, it's like, is the technology going to be producible at scale, yeah, or are other underlying technologies going to be subject to disruption or sabotage? And so, what I'm talking about there, we saw with Nord Stream, obviously it was some form of industrial sabotage. And then more recently, my understanding is that the Houthis had disabled or otherwise damaged fiber optic cables along like the bottom of the Red Sea to wow, disrupt communications. So I would encourage people to check the latest, because depending on when this airs, that story might have changed or there might be updates. But there's a lot of technologies that are necessary for all of this stuff to run. You're talking about chips, but certainly power, internet connections, the operating systems themselves. And I think that the scenario you're describing is something that's, I don't know if it's going to be a chip shortage, although that's certainly likely, but it's somewhat inevitable that there's going to be some type of major disruption to these, I don't know how to describe it, but it's like a security tech stack that relies on AI or connection to the cloud or, you know, outsourcing data processing capabilities or edge computing devices as part of its calculation or analytics. Something for sure is going to take out one of those things for some period of time. And yeah, it's going to either be a crisis itself, or it's going to accompany a different crisis as part of a threat actor's penetration attempt.
So over-reliance on technology in the future is probably, to Carlos's point, we still need to rely on what Carlos calls the bombs and bad guys, or Gates, guards and guns, you know, that is probably not going away anytime soon, but we still will need to augment with artificial intelligence and technology, compute at the edge, you know, type technology, I think. But you're suggesting that and I think maybe this is even AI assisted ability to hack or to disrupt through advanced hacking methods, our infrastructure around physical security. So you see a future where that's possible as well, it sounds like.
There's so many things that can, so if you think about a really complex system, and I'm not an engineer, but just think about a complex machine versus a simple machine in your own life, a golf lawnmower versus, you know, a contemporary car engine. There's a lot more things that can go wrong with the modern car engine, and it's a lot easier to fix the golf mower. And so if you've got all these components that are put, you know, either pieced together, you know, connected through APIs, or, you know, they rely on applications and clients on different machines and all of that, there's just a lot more stuff that can go wrong.
Sure. That even goes to data center security too, Carlos.
Well, I was going to say, are we going to have to go back to analog, man? Should I just, you know, start running wires again? And, you know, and I mean that for, you know, every place still has satellite phones and stuff like that, just waiting for, you know, for technology to fail, right, to be used. And a lot of places use it. I am a little worried, though, is that at least for our everyday life, we're going to need so much minerals and whatever it is that's available for us to use for to machine these things, to make them happen, that the countries that are producing them in masses now, like China, you know, you talk about China all the time, Scott. We talked a little bit about even the country where I was born, Brazil, which is the fifth largest country in the world, has the rainforest. Like, I don't hear much from them, but they also have, Brazil is heavy into human rights, which connects right into the deforestation of the rainforest and people digging holes in Brazil. I mean, that's a real big thing in Brazil, and it's not no different than the U.S., by the way, when it comes to that kind of stuff. But big countries like that are going to have to step up that today are not in it in order to keep this thing going, I think, in the future.
Yeah, interesting point. Maybe that's why Brazil is going after an alliance with BRICS, you know, with other, you know, I'll say less reputable in the international world or the global South. You know, they're looking for partners across the world that are not normally partnered with like Iran or Russia, you know, and Russia is not partnered with only really because of Ukraine and the sanctions that have been placed on it. But, you know, one thing's for sure, we're going into a world that we don't have to necessarily shoot a piece of lead or metal at each other to really disrupt our lives. And that's the thing I think I'm most worried about, Andrew, because I've said it before, and that I believe in a reliance to some extent on digital or internet or some type of technology in relation to corporate security. But the more I think about it, the more concerned I am that the technology just won't be there, as well as it we're going to be going so fast with so few resources that, you know, because if we go at the same clip that we're going right now, and right now we have the baby boomers to help us kind of maintain, but in the next few years, baby boomers are out of the workforce in mass, probably starts by next year is my assessment. But so we don't have the eyes to watch these things. We don't have the people to make sure the settings are correct. I mean, how many times have we, you know, this just happened with a company called Facebook and Instagram. They just went down, right? Somebody forgot to do something, or they pushed a stack the wrong way, or they didn't think through all these things. And I don't know that we're going to have the people to make sure that we are doing these things right. And will that leave us vulnerable, Andrew, to potential attack? And or can we use AI to help defend us?
So that's a fascinating question too. Forgive me, hanged up that call. All right, thank you. Yeah, so that's a fascinating question. Are we going to be able to have enough people to make sure that this technology is properly implemented and is running the right way?
Yeah.
The answer is, I think the reason I would say no is because, one, just the population demographics you described. Although there's some argument to be made that digital natives might be more effective in the, you know, technology intervention but population will do part of it. Another reason for that, I think, is because when we don't have enough people for something, our inclination is to use machines or to outsource it. And so at a certain point, outsourcing won't be available or strategically advisable because, you know, you mentioned BRICS earlier. It's like, how comfortable are you with a development team located in a region of the world that is partnered with perhaps your country's global adversary or a couple of them? Are you comfortable assigning sensitive tasks to development teams over there? Not trying to pick on anybody. It's just kind of, you got to make these kind of strategic calculations if you're thinking about stability of these systems. And so then we're probably going to turn to technology to some extent to self-improving technology. Right. Or just whether it's data collection, whether it's running experimental models, whatever the type of tech superpowers we try to outsource. And then so you end up with a sort of loop where you're trying to get better and use technology to figure out the ways how to better use technology. And so it's like, if if an incentive structure that isn't good to us, but is good to the machine is somehow like running, things could go haywire pretty fast. You know, it might read signals 100 million times. To your point about watching the settings, it's like an AI could read a signal 100 million times and come up with a conclusion that's not one that we would choose.
Right. Which could be good and it could be bad.
That's why when you're talking about reading and doing the mathematics way faster than we can to put it together,
yeah,
I always talk about how I feel that quantum computing, when it comes to security and a security threat, is more scary to me than AI.
Tell me. That's,
okay. Well, here's the difference for me. So AI, I view it as a human being, and a human being is fallible, where mathematics, it's just 1 + 1 = 2 and it doesn't change. Right. And if you get it, if you can do the math, you get it right. And usually it's kind of part of that whole STEM system, science and everything else. And it's been approved and tried to be disproved 100 million times. So here it is. So AI, the way I see AI is that you have to do a lot of work as an AI person to do all the things that you're trying to do now. So if I make a phone call to you, Andrew, and I say, hey, Andrew, what's going on, man? Let's say you are my coordinator. Hey, I lost my password here to my computer real quick. Can you do me a favor? What's that password again that we have on file for this bank account? Right. And the whole time you think it's me. And I somehow cloned the phone number that I'm calling from, or you know, hey, I'm calling from the office out here in L.A. You're not going to look at the number. If it's an L.A. number, you're fine. But you recognize my voice and we're good to go. But that takes the system a lot to learn my voice, to put it together, to be able to get it going. And in order to create this entire thing that I'm going to talk about, where quantum computing has no feelings, doesn't have to figure out how to create me and my voice. All it cares about is just numbers and computing as fast as possible to gain entry into like somebody's computer. So forget about all the cryptography that are out there, you know, today, RSSs, whatever the case may be. The math will work so fast that it doesn't need to create a second Carlos in order to try to confuse someone into giving me anything. I don't have to set up a plan for it. All I do is tell the mathematics, get into this door, and the quantum computing will just extremely fast do the numbers to get into that, whatever that coded entry point that you have on your computer or whatever that is. I just think that the AI takes a little bit more work to get into. It's more like what I want to say, it's more like social engineering still that AI is going to have to do, where the mathematics behind it, they don't need to do anything. All we got to do is just get into that computer and the math will do it itself. First thoughts.
So is your I guess what I'm going to say, what you said a little bit differently, and you tell me if I'm on track here. Yep. So you're basically saying, in a world where entry to a lot of sensitive areas is ultimately an alphanumeric code.
Yes.
In an area, in a world where that's true, that a quantum computing system, which is basically like a master decoder that understands different, you know, character strings and probabilities and how many times it can guess wrong before it flags. It's like a master decoder. It's basically like a skeleton key that opens up anything that's locked with an alphanumeric code. That's kind of, that's how you see it.
That's pretty much it. So even if we have like this, like ECC, like it's a elliptical, like curve cryptography, that it's, you know, the public key encryption stuff. Right. And it's on the elliptic curve theory, where it's always bending, it's always changing. It's a curve. It's a curvature that never ends, right? Well, I think that quantum computers are going to be able to get there so much faster than the curve, because it'll know exactly where the number will be before even that kind of cryptography, you know, gets in a way. Even the simple kind of RSA encryption that we have today, which is a lot of data encryption that you see like in the emails, you know, I mean, that's a way simpler math, by the way. It's just the old kind of, I don't know, what you call like a digital transaction or something in the emails or on the net, right? I just think that quantum computing will be able to beat that so much faster than for me to design someone that's going to act like me, talk like me, be like me, to get past other programs that will be built to fight people that look like me, talk like me, but are not me. Because hopefully we'll create some kind of, today I guess would be password or some kind of fingerprint or something, you know, that would automatically, every communication I have to, before I talk to my mom, you know, I have to go, here's the password, bananas, right? And whatever the password may be. But anyways, I know it's a crazy thought. It's a weird thought. I just think that mathematically, those things would be so, and by the way, more of an impact. If they just get my bank account, that's fine. You know, but in quantum computing, if they get the entire bank's bank account where everybody holds their money, that's a bigger problem.
Go ahead, Scott.
No,
it's a theory. It's just a theory that I have out there.
Yeah. You know? And that's my concern. We kind of go to a zero ability to secure data. But how do we use AI to help us when we don't have the people to do it?
And this is just kind of off the cuff, but if I were just trying to think through how I might go about using AI, like what are all the places I would try to plug AI in? Yeah. I would say one of the first would probably be, you know, we're talking about a couple different doomsday scenarios, so to speak, and they're somewhat at opposite ends of the spectrum. You know, the insufficient chips hypothesis, which I think is a good one, that suggests some sort of downgrade in tech abilities, right? And mm-hmm. Carlos at the other end of the spectrum is like, no, what about this souped up computing capability that comes with quantum? So the first thing we should probably use AI to do is see if we can figure out probabilities of some of this stuff. What's the actual likelihood based on whatever available data we have of different types of disastrous, you know, chip shortages, fiber optic severing, all that stuff. And two, say like the commercial, like the weaponization, like see how AI would assess the probability and potentially even the timeline for the weaponization of quantum computing. So, you know, it's like, you know what I'm saying, you could like model this out potentially and you could
have. I like this idea. So, so we do tabletop exercises, right? Or we've talked about them, doing them. If you aren't doing them, you should do them. But I like this idea of you could almost tabletop anything with AI by running it through these various models and seeing what it comes up with. Hey, this is the parameters around my risk, and then apply quantum computing to it. What are the possible outcomes? And I haven't done this, but I'm sure AI could give us some probabilities that we should consider.
Yeah, I think you just nailed it. It's, you would want to incorporate it into some sort of tabletop exercise as well. And if you, I think, you know, your original scenario involved the sort of the decline or the sunsetting of the baby boomers and their expertise. If you think about, it's like, how to use them as force multipliers. Just thinking about them, it's like this is a finite information resource. It becomes less knowledgeable, not necessarily less knowledgeable, but it will start to lose connection and become less good as they age, as we all do. It's like we need to basically get all of their experience out of them right now.
Yeah.
And we need to, and teach, transmit information quickly. And AI is outstanding at transmitting information quickly.
I'll tell you, the way I feel is like this. AI is going to help us get to quantum computing so much faster because companies today are spending a tremendous amount of money on generative AI, which are a lot faster, quicker, smoother, cooler running computers, because that's a problem when you're doing the math that fast. You need to be able to really keep things cool. Data centers are amazing at doing that. They're getting better and better every single day. So I think that, so obviously the quantum computing is still very theoretical. Like I said, it's a theory that I have out there. And the idea that I think you'll be a current threat to the cryptography that I mentioned that we have today, right? RSS, ECC kind of cryptographic security stuff. All right. But I think those things are also going to get better. Okay. So don't get me wrong. But I do believe that the amount of investment that's being put into faster computing, which through AI, okay, is going to lead us to get to quantum computing a lot faster, because today computers are not powerful enough. They're not sufficiently and nowhere close to being powerful enough to doing what the idea is. Yeah. But I think with the work that we're doing in AI right now, it'll get us there.
That makes a lot of sense. And I've heard of a number of different groups that are using AI as part of their R&D process. They can run a variety of different models. As long as we have data on something, they can run models, right? But it's like when you think about, I'm not familiar with really how to engineer quantum computers, but if you think about the basic stuff that we need, and you think about an AI helping us to develop that technology, this is where we have to be cautious, and like the sci-fi scenarios can start to emerge. But that whatever any technology that AI is helping us develop, that it is doing so from a framework and a prioritization system that we endorse. That's probably one of the biggest risks as we think about how to mitigate against the risk of AI in the future. It's like sort of how are we training it now? Mm. And the incentives a lot of times seem to be getting things into market as quickly as possible, as opposed to developing the safest system.
I want to propose a question. So it's kind of like the egg and the chicken with, I think, AI and quantum computing kind of thing. One of them is going to get better as the other one gets better. Maybe that's where we're at with that. But how do we create this trusted kind of security ecosystem, regardless if the AI comes or quantum computing comes? How do we set policies just for the security? I'm not talking about global policies. God, there's plenty of governmental people that want to get involved in all of that for sure. And I mean, I know companies today, they're hiring AI lawyers already that only focus on that. How do we as security folks try to create this kind of what I'm calling a trusted security ecosystem all around us, where everything and anything that protects my company, protects me, is protected some way, shape, or form? How do we just start to even think about building that kind of stuff, man? I'm not an engineer. I don't know. But how do you do it? And maybe I should call what is it? Kurzweil, I can never say his name, or even Michio Kaku is another one that's really good on the future.
Sure, Michio is not doing anything. He wants to come on Corporate Security University podcast.
I'm going to have to call him. Even Harari, right? Harari is another one that I was just reading on the other day, Yuval Harari. So I don't know, guys. I don't know. How do we build this ecosystem?
I'll just say this. I mean, this is the brilliance of you, Carlos. I think you've already answered this question. And that is that we have to, if we want to, what's the best way to gain trust and to build this trusted ecosystem? We have to start with the person-to-person relationships and the people-to-people interactions, the in-person interactions. So we're all of this stuff that we're doing in the cloud, every password we can put on, that's all the stuff that can be faked. Deep fake videos.
Yep.
It's a long time before we're going to be having deep fake holograms walk into your office building and shake your hand, and that's so I think part of it is maybe it's like certain discussions. So it could be certain conversations or certain types of meetings or interactions that has to occur in person. Or if there's a disaster of some sort, it's like, no, you can't do that virtual war room over there. You got to drive your ass to the office, and we're going to meet in this room, and we're going to hash it out. I don't know. Maybe that's oversimplifying.
I kind of use that today, you know, like whenever I don't want to type something out, right, I just call somebody. That's my my way of being safe, where what I say like does not go anywhere else. Yeah. So I hear you. I was like, now it's the future is going to be like, no, bro. I need to see you in person.
Yeah.
But this is interesting. We talk about how do we send and ensure data security. The government's been doing this for 100 years. You know, this is the old Pony Express idea. If you want to deliver something and you want to ensure that it's going to get, it's important, it's going to get to the person that it's going to, you're going to have a messenger, right? And you're going to have the seal, the ring in the wax on the seal. And, you know, the government does do this and has been doing it for many, many years, where they have couriers that run around the world delivering diplomatic pouches and so on. But because they can't trust the transmission, I mean, when I was in the government, and this is no secret, but I was in the government, I had a top secret clearance, and we have
That's a secret. A top secret clearance is a secret.
No, it's a top secret secret.
Oh, it's a top secret. Got it. Got it.
Secret, okay. Got it. Top secret? Yeah. Now we're getting confused.
Do you have any documents in your garage, by the way, or your bathroom?
So the kind of the running joke was that some of our computer systems that were supposed to be quote unquote classified had already been breached by nation states. And but the real secret, really classified ones, no, they hadn't gotten into those. Like, oh, okay. Then why do we have couriers running around the world, you know, with sealed diplomatic pouches, essentially doing what they did in the Roman times? Because it works. And, you know, perhaps to your point, Carlos, you know, how do we authenticate that there this person is the person that I want to do business with, without some intermediary who's going to go, yes, I put eyes on that person and I verified their ID and all these things. Like when you go to cash a check, you know, you take your ID in there and you cash a check and the bank has to do some level of verification. Maybe there's something in the future that we go, to your point, analog, and it becomes very much, if it's a really important deal or if it's a really important document or really important data, you hire this human courier and they do that. Business moves too fast to do this in mass, I think, but you're right. It is something that, you know, maybe that should be considered, because we all know if you store something in a data center, that's just somebody else's computer. The blade that sits in the stack is somebody else's computer. And we don't have any control over that necessarily, which makes data center security an interesting topic of discussion too.
I might be wrong on this one, fellas, but is there a movie out there, and we may need to write the script on this thing, is there a movie out there that is way in the future, to the point that things that are being moved that are extremely important are done by some kind of badass dude that nobody really knows that his job literally is to deliver? That's what I don't know. I'm at, it, honestly.
Johnny Mnemonic, is that the one with the Matrix guy?
With the John Reeves. Wick guy.
Yes.
Or give it to John Wick. That's a man that.
Or, yeah. Or, you know, that's even better. Yeah, he did a movie like a long time ago where they would like upload the data into his brain. And then, you know, so his threat to the bad guys was he'd hold a gun to his own head and be like, oh, I'll take the data with me. Yeah, so that could be it, Carlos.
All right, my fault. Okay. Well, I should have known something like that. I know. I can't. AI can do pretty good at the plagiarism. I don't need to do it myself.
Yeah. It's like, and I guess it's when you think about like speed of business and what do you need, like what has to occur via digital communication, what could be done in person. It's like, I think this is where your SOPs are going to be really important. It's just like, what? So just say, I'm making this up on the spot, but if you're a bank and you've got offices and different locations, you've got people that can make decisions about money transfers and these different locations. If you lose, your network is down, no one can access account information or whatever. Nobody transfers any money. And no one's transferring money until we can all get together and talk about it, or whatever the policy may be, until we can get on this other channel of communications that's, you know, we never open except when we've got a crisis like this. I don't know, but it's, you gotta have, you just have to have people. I think the military, this, I have no military experience, but I've, when I read about strategies from historical battles, I think the military probably has some really good thinkers in terms of how to prepare for every scenario and how to respond.
Yeah, not to go too deep into Hollywood, but that was depicted in Crimson Tide with Denzel and I can't remember the Gene Hackman, I think is
Alabama, the right? Alabama.
Yeah.
Okay. Alabama.
Yeah, so they're underwater and they receive a communication, but the communication is like not complete, and it's the launch order. You shall launch, and then there's the big, you know, disagreement on if we launch, you know, nukes at Russia or do we not? Do we follow our conscience? And but to your point, yeah. Or do are we in? I mean, we've seen this happen, right, with the Sony hack. So Sony gets hacked, and they are literally back to runners between departments with sticky notes telling people what to do. And that went on for several weeks. I've talked to the former head of security at Sony, who told me this wild story when they got hacked, that literally everything went down and just everything stops. And so, but business wants to keep going. And I think most people in business are eager to learn how to adapt, and are pretty flexible. Whereas the military really, you know, it's like, I was given an order, I'm going to carry that out. It's my mission. But I think people in the private sector are pretty flexible. I've had many opportunities to work disasters in corporations, mainly with Silicon Valley companies. But, you know, even in the manufacturing company, we've had similar situations where, you know, something gets hacked and then machines go offline. What do you do? And it's all hands on deck, and people work hard, and they don't. I don't recall a situation where people said, you know, I'm not doing that. And so that's one good thing. The human element is like, everybody's going to pitch in and we're going to work hard to figure out what to do next. But I kind of wish we would build, to your point, Andrew, SOPs or protocols or awareness or redundancies or just additional capabilities. You know, some companies, you know, at least every company I've been at where I've asked this question about the specific tool, I've received the, we're not going to do that. There's no reason to do that. And it's around satellite communications. And it's, hey, we would like the CEO to have a satellite phone should they need it. We'd like other executives to have satellite phones. And that, you know, realize it's an expense, you know, it's a cost center. And you're going to pay a monthly fee, or you're going to pay, quarterly or yearly or whatever it is. And there are different ways to do it now. It's much, much more easy than giving everybody a satellite phone. You can give somebody a satellite hotspot, so they don't even need an additional phone. But I get a lot of pushback when we throw this out there. And my concern, to your point, Andrew, is when something does happen and people can't communicate, are we over-reliant on communications? I hope not. And I hope people can be adaptable and they can find somebody who has that authority or that confidence to make a call, make a good call, where they have the experience and the time under the belt, and they know the kind of the right parameters and the left parameters. But my concern is that we're going into a world where we don't have somebody with that much time. And Carlos and I talk about it as the 25-year-old CSO. You know, if we don't have them already, we're going to have them. And they're going to have a few years of experience, and then they're going to be thrown into the top job. Well, if we extrapolate that across all business units, are we going to have the 30-year-old CEO, the 30-year-old big company, or the 30-year-old COO? Because, hey, I've been here for 5 years and I know how this thing works. But do you have that experience level to make a crisis call?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly what he said. It's going to be a conundrum. Are we not intelligent enough right now, fellas, to to even think of what the future is like. I mean, can I use, and this is a serious question, man, can I use Star Trek, you know, like beam me up, Scotty, kind of deal to go, okay, when we get there, okay, now we really got to worry about all these things. And, or should we just go back to talking about like virtual reality? You know, 10, 15 years ago, virtual reality was going to be it. And virtual reality kind of still in a way trying to make its way in. Some people are calling it, I saw a term which is a little bit different than what I knew, which is called live reality, where it's in your glasses, right? You know, Scott, people, you won't be able to see this, but Scott is wearing glasses right now. But while he's talking to me, he's seeing everything else within his glasses that he wants to see or needs to see, whatever the case may be, right? He might be watching the news right now while talking to us, or we are part of his screen in his glasses more than a computer screen. Well, that's kind of like the, you know, I've heard of as augmented reality. That's always been my thing, right? AR, AR. But is it so live reality now where I'm, you know, who knows what it is? Is that out? Is that out? Or are we going to be able to incorporate all that into AI and then into security?
You're talking to, so I guess with augmented reality, you know, there's a couple like Oculus and, Apple have both released the different versions of the goggles. And I have not personally worn the Apple ones. I've seen a couple, you know, inside the visor views. But one of the things that kind of struck me about that is, so the arrangements I've seen, they're kind of integrating their workspace into their living room. Why you would want to do that, I don't know. But like, but
you
the-
You can go anywhere.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna go in my living room.
It's what, like what I, where I think that's going to be headed for some people is they're going to try to, instead of having 14 applications open on their phone and different interfaces and different buttons and colors and all of that, is there's going to be, people are basically going to outsource that to an AI assistant where they, so they'll use augmented reality and they'll combine it with an AI assistant and it will just minimize the appearance of technology in their lives.
I love that idea so much. I want to do it now. You know, I'd love to, I stress this, Carlos and I talk about this all the time because one time he shared his screen with me and I saw all the emails on his personal email. And I was like, Carlos, you have like 500 unread emails. And Carlos, what did you say to me?
If it's important, don't get a hold of me again.
I wish I could be like that.
Because I learned that a long time ago and it was a story that I heard from, I don't know exactly who I heard it from, but this is the deal. I'll get to the things that are really important. I know who they are, you know, and everything else. And then, somebody told me that like this executive went on a vacation. You guys might've heard this story. Give me a thumbs up if you have, but some executive goes out on this vacation and comes back from vacation. He's got like 1,000 emails. Right. And then he decides that he's just going to delete them all. He's going to delete them all and see if somebody really, now that they know that he's back, that they really need to get a hold of him, if they will email him again or reach out to him again and say, I know you just got back. There's some, this email that you need to look at. Right. And ended up that he got like 6 of those out of 1,000 plus emails that he had. It was 6 of them. He deleted it all. Right. So crazy to think this way, but what I've realized is that we have so many ways to communicate in text messages, you know, inside pinging systems, Slack kind of systems, you name it. And then when people are back, you know, my folks already know that if it's something important, do me a favor, either send me a text message or send me a ping and let me know, hey boss, just send you an email. It's important. Or, you know, and I usually tell them, I hate to not press the go button whenever people use their personal credit cards or their company cards, whatever the case may be, to go and approve those expenses. Because I don't know how people are living day to day, man. And you know, I want them to get the money as fast as possible to replenish that credit card, right? So I tell my team, look, if it's important to you and you want me to see it, aka like you used your personal card, ping me, text me, do something that's going to take, because I get so many emails a day, you know, that anyway, I don't know where I was going with that, but.
Back to you, Scott. Well, no, I mean, we're talking about, you know, using AI to handle take away as a personal assistant, you know, to that point, Carlos, maybe somebody says, hey, they send you an email and they say, hey, can you approve this? AI and Andrew, you know, I think we're probably aligned here, but AI would pick that up and be like, oh, I know based on whatever parameters that this is going to be important to Carlos. So I'm going to divert it from email and send it to his Slack, for example. And then you can, you know, take it from there because you'll see that before you'll see the email.
I think that's a really good example. You could imagine a scenario where AI could actually auto approve some of that stuff. If there's certain parameters, an expense made from of a certain size, made from a particular vendor during, you know, at a certain time frame like that, you could program that. And just on that, you know, I think when we think about this AI assistant and we think about that concept, you're this 25-year-old CSO who maybe understands technology very well, but doesn't have a lot of reps and doesn't have a lot of time in the game. Well, how will they do in crisis? When we think about that concept of the assistant, did you guys ever play Halo, you know, Cortana? So it's like, so if we should be building, if maybe someone is already, a Cortana-like security advisor, or it could be like if you saw Quantum Leap, like Al, you know, but basically where you turn that general intelligence AI, point that to every military treatise, statistics from every battle, supply, you know, what types of weapons were used.
I'm going to start.
God. Every crime, every, you know, give it all that data. And then interview security leaders, analyze commonalities between their case studies.
I'm going to say it now, March 8th, 13:54 hours, California time. This is what I'm going to say right now. What I need is an app that can do that and consistently follow me around and jump in my ears every time my wife asks some kind of a question or has kind of something that automatically picks up data and tells me you'll have a 75% chance of getting the answer right if you say this. And it gives me real quick, right? A real quick data. But what I mean by that is exactly what you're saying, Andrew, is that anything in my life, if I have to make a decision like this 25-year-old CEO, if I have to make constant decisions every single day, I don't, who knows how many decisions I have to make a day, but I make a lot of decisions a day. It would be great if automatically you would get percentages and ideas, but then would we really be taking our own lives in our own hands?
I'll even add on to that because I think about this a lot too with what I call job fraud. And to your point about it's in my ear and it's telling me the answer, are we going, I think we already are in a direction, at least in the initial stages of interviewing a job candidate who looks great on paper, but they don't know anything. And because we're all virtual, they're able to answer things quickly by using ChatGPT or any of the AIs. So if in a technical world, you know, I go up for a compute job and they're asking me in real time, hey, so do you like C++ or Security Plus? And I have no idea what either of those things mean. But in my ear, my AI is telling me how to answer that. So I think that we are probably already have seen it, but we're going to continue to see the death of specialties, right? Because everybody becomes a specialist and can as AI continues to learn, and AI today will be different in 2 years and 5 years and 10 years. It will be much more knowledgeable about how to do things. The problem is the data set that it's learning from. So while it's telling you something in your ear, and I've experienced this a little bit with being in college, I like to compare what I'm reading to what is Chad, we call it Chad, Andrew, Chad GTP, what does Chad say, you know? And sometimes they're pretty far off. And so one thing I do like about Microsoft's version is that it gives you resources on where it's getting its data. And that's really important, because one thing that Carlos and I always say is, if you're going to use that to try and understand corporate security applications or operations better, you better also have the experience to know when it's lying to you. And that's obviously not intentionally lying, but when it's giving you bad information or information that might be incomplete, so that you don't look like you don't know what you're doing. Carlos's point, it's in your ear, and maybe somebody says, hey, yeah, so how many megapixels on a security camera do you want to watch a large open area? And in your ear,
minimum of 10 megapixels at 30 frames per second.
Yeah, let's say it goes 2 megapixels.
Oh, I made a mistake. It's perfect. You done did it. You done did it. That's no good.
See, that's the problem. And so we have this learning model that maybe it will give you some false positives and false negatives that you thought you were right. And it sounds good, right? It was in my ear. But I think we need to be concerned about that too, or at least aware of it, not concerned. Well, maybe.
It's funny that you said that. I just saw that on chat, our friend Chad, the other day. Actually, in the bottom now, it says something like, we make mistakes too. You might want to check. You might want to check this stuff to see. To see, especially if it's an important information, something like that. I saw it in the bottom of it. It's like, oh, okay, all right. You guys are finding different ways to cover yourself, you know, because people are probably using it as the truth. It wasn't the truth, and they sued Chad for some odd reason, right?
Yeah, people are using it to become quote-unquote experts at things. What do you think, Andrew? You think that's something that is going to be broader in the future, or do you think that's something that's here now?
I think you're definitely onto something there. And so I don't remember who said this, but I remember reading a while ago how the premium for human intelligence used to be broad expertise in a number of domains. So if you look at like the founding fathers of this country, they were farmers, you know, they had like multiple skill sets that they were skilled with. But then it changed to, are you a person that's able to access the information you need at a kind of like a just-in-time basis? Right. So you need to know how to. So it's like it moved from knowing a bunch of stuff about a number of topics to, can you get to the information that you need now? And it's what you're describing, Scott, just seems like a continuation of that, of somebody being able to either brush up quick or even fake knowledge. And one other topic on that, like to echo a point you made, the concern about bias in your artificial intelligence. And bias could be to or for or against something. And it's not only can they get things wrong, like historically, but they can impose incorrect impressions based upon some system of values they have.
God. Okay. Well, listen, this is a good one. We're going to get into blockchain, I think, in the future. I want to see how that's going to be used. Like a Bitcoin with a ledger. I want to see how that's going to work for security. So many different things, guys. But we got to cut it. Sadly, we have to cut this one off. It is that time. We're coming up on an hour plus. Who knows where we're at these days. But Andrew, always a pleasure, my friend, hanging out with you. You are an incredible human being. By the way, Andrew Saluke. No, he told me, look, man, you say it as if it was salute. And now all I can think of is salute instead of saluke. Saluke. See what I mean? I can't get it right now. I forget it's over. But hey, I want to thank you, man. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for actually throwing out the idea. Hey, let's just talk about this stuff, see where it leads. I appreciate that. Yeah. Scotty, you know, really good stuff. But thank you. We'll catch up next time, everybody. Thank you for listening on this one. We're going to expand on it. Expound, that's in the past. See, I was born in Brazil. You got to give me a couple of tries every once in a while with the American language. I'm still working through it. But listen, I want to thank everybody that keeps on listening to this. We're working hard at Corporate Security University to expand minds, make sure that the business that we're in, corporate security, is becoming better and better every single day, that we're involved, that we are part of the group that is making things better for each one of us around. So thank you very much for being part of this. I am Carlos Francisco.
And I'm Scott Walker.
This is Corporate Security University.
Security excellence through education.
There we go. Take care, everybody. We will catch you later.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Andrew. Bye-bye now. See you guys.
Goodbye.
Security excellence through education. Corporate Security University.